Last week, as Baltimore was slowly shutting down, I had an appointment with a non-Jewish dentist, and she was reflecting on the craziness of everything that was going on around us, and she commented, you know, what a crazy world it is, but then quickly added, but it's okay, we just have to wait. Soon everything will be back to normal, everyone will be back to normal, we'll forget about all of this, it'll be as if it never happened. Now, it's good I couldn't respond because her hand was down my throat. But I was reflecting at the time how different our attitude is from that attitude. But what is the difference? We know that in Yeshaya gives very harsh muster to Bnei Yisrael, Perek Aleph, and he accuses them, Va'ami lo hisbonin. He accuses them, you know, my nation is just not understanding. My nation is just not getting it. My nation's just not realizing that things happen for a reason, that events in the world are intended for us to take a message. Here Hashem was trying to wake them up. They're heading for a Chorban, time of Yeshaya, and they're not listening to Nevi'im. They're not changing. They're not doing anything about it. They're just saying, oh, you know, what awful coincidences are going on around us. Lamenting, how tragic, Va'ami lo hisbonen. Yeshaya's words ring as true, as applicable as ever, right now in Tafshin Pei. It's almost as if Hashem is sending us messages. I'm shaking up the world for you to take a message. Wake up, do tshuva, take a lesson, think about it. And how tragic it is when Va'ami lo hisbonen, when we're all just not getting it. Do you know the reason for thunder, the purpose of thunder? Well, if I recall correctly from my fifth grade science, I think scientists say something along the lines of that there are two rain-laden clouds, and these two clouds bang into each other, and so the force of it makes a loud boom of thunder, and the electrical current that's sent from the crashing of the two clouds is what we see as lightning. And then from the force of these two rain-laden clouds banging together, that's why rain usually follows thundering and lightning. Well, that might be the reason that scientists give for thunder. In the Gemara, though, there's a different reason for thunder. In the Gemara, it's brought down that when Hashem wants to wake us up, he takes these two rain-laden clouds, he bangs them into each other, it makes a frightening noise, a person hears this noise, recognizes the might of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why we say the bracha shekacha ugvuraso malei olam. And then we're zocha to the bracha of rain. If that's the purpose of something as ordinary, as run-of-the-mill, as normal, as thunder, then certainly the events around us are one loud, rumbling, crashing thunder intended for us to wake up, to recognize the might of Hashem. But again, how sad it is when Va'ami lo hisbonen, when we're just not getting it. Now, obviously, I'm talking to myself more than I'm talking to any of you. We know that the easiest way to take any lesson is when you say it, when you speak about it, when you think about it, and then it forces you to, you know, maybe change a little. So clearly, I'll just make this disclaimer now. I'm talking to myself. The Chafetz Chaim brings down that any time there are world events that happen, it has to be that it's a message for Klal Yisrael. Any time, whether it affects us directly, which in this case, unfortunately, it is, or even if it doesn't. Meaning, even when it was still going on only in China and it was still, you know, foreign news that we all laughed about, but clearly that's meant for us to take a message. So he says, why is that the case? So he explains it with a muscle. He says, look, imagine if you have someone who is living in a building and they speak a different language than the rest of the building. You know, for example, let's say you have one Mexican living in an English-speaking building. And the Mexican speaks Spanish, the rest of the building speaks English. So let's say a letter arrives to this building, to someone in this building, and the letter is written in Spanish. So I don't even have to look at who the letter is addressed to know that it's intended for this Mexican in the building, because he's the only one that understands that language. So it can't be for anyone else, because no one else is going to understand it. So the Chafetz Chaim draws from there and says, so when events happen in the world around us, whether it affects us directly or even if it doesn't affect us yet directly, it has to be that it's a message to us because we're the only ones who understand that language. We're the only ones who understand the language of cause and effect. We're the only ones who are capable of understanding the language of Hashem is doing something for a reason. We're the only ones who aren't capable of understanding the language of Hashem is doing something to wake us up and wants us to take something from it and wants us to change, right? We're the only ones who understand that language, and therefore it has to be that's intended for us. You know, with this, I understand my dentist. It's okay for her to say, you know, all this will pass. We'll be back to normal. Don't worry, honey. Because that's not her language, right? The language of taking lessons from events going on around is not her language. So yeah, sure, everything's going to be back to normal. She'll be back to normal. We'll forget about it as if it never happened. But we can't afford to leave the letter unopened. We can't afford to leave ourselves unchanged because Hashem is clearly speaking to us. Along the same lines, we have that in Hazinu, Bnei Yisrael, the relationship between Bnei Yisrael and Hashem is comparable to that of an eagle and its young. Kenesher Ya'ir Kino. That just like an eagle arouses, wakens its young, that's the way Hashem wakes us up. So how does an eagle arouse its young? So it's brought down that an eagle, because it's such a large, imposing, intimidating, frightening bird, unlike other birds that would just fly directly and land on their nest when they're ready to fly to their nest, an eagle would first rustle the branches, right? As it gets closer to its nest, it would rustle the branches, move the leaves, shake the trees of the surrounding areas in order that its young should wake up slowly, without the fright, without the fear. And only once its young are woken from the rustling of the branches, it gets closer and closer, the rustling gets louder and louder, and then it will descend on its nest, right? Not to frighten its young too much. So that's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu deals with us as well. When he wants to wake us up for whatever reason, he first rustles the branches. First things happen that are far away from us and far away communities in China and Thailand and Spain and Italy, wherever it might be, right? And then if we don't wake up, well, then he gets a little closer and closer and closer, Lo Aleinu, and the rustling of the branches gets a little bit louder, a little bit closer. But the point is that we have to wake up, right? And therefore, he's going to keep getting closer and closer until we wake up. You know, it almost reminds me of, you know, those alarm clocks that they start off with like a nice little, you know, idle, quiet sounding beep, 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 beep. But if you don't get the message, right, meaning if you don't get up and turn off the alarm clock gets louder and louder. Beep, 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 beep. Until, you know, the whole house seems to be shaking with this beep, beep, beep. But we could choose to wake up before it's blaring, right? We could choose to wake up before it's loud and screeching. But it's so much easier to turn over and push the snooze button, right? Or it's so much easier just to ignore it and put the pillow over our head. But then it has to get louder and louder. I assume you're familiar with Chiel, right? Who lived in the time of Achav, Harasha. So we know that years earlier, Yehoshua had, after destroying Jericho, had banned the building of Jericho, had said that no one is allowed to build Jericho, not now and not in the future either. It has to lay in ruins. And he said it so strongly that he added a klala. He said that anyone who does attempt to build up Jericho, when they first begin to build the city, when they lay the foundations, this person's oldest child is going to die. And as they continue building, their children will continue dying. Until when they finish the city, when they put in the doorknobs, then their youngest child is going to die. Right? Yehoshua left it very, very, made it very, very specific exactly what's going to happen to someone who tries to build up Jericho. So years later, we have that this Chiel comes, and this Chiel sees a beautiful, potentially beautiful city anyway, lying in ruins, and he sees a very nice, profitable real estate venture, and he rationalizes. You know, at the time, Bnei Yisrael were serving Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah was rampant, and there was plenty of rainfall, even though Moshe Rabbeinu had given a klala, that one who does not listen, and one who serves Avodah Zarah, that there's not going to be rain. So Chiyo rationalizes, look, if the klala of the Rebbe, of Moshe Rabbeinu, isn't coming true, well, then the klala of the Talmud, of Yehoshua, what he said regarding building Yericho, is also not going to come true. And so he decides that he is going to pursue this real estate venture, and he's going to build up the city. And what happens? He starts building up the city, and sure enough, his sons start to die, right? The first son, when he lays the foundation, and then subsequent sons die, and he just continues right on with his building of the city. Girls, did you ever? Like, his sons are dying. Like, doesn't he draw a parallel that, like, maybe he should stop, that maybe this does have something to do with the klala of Yehoshua? Right? But was he heartless? Was he cruel? Was he dumb? You know, I don't think he was any of the above. I don't think he was heartless. I don't think he was cruel. I don't think he was dumb. I think he probably loved his sons. I think that he simply didn't allow himself to think. He was so determined that he wanted to build up the city that he didn't allow himself to draw a conclusion that maybe his sons are dying and it has to do with him and that maybe he should stop. Because in his mind, he was already set, this is what he wanted to do. You know, in my imagination, he thought something along the lines of, you know, what an awful, freaky, terrible, tragic plague is going on that happens to be taking the lives of my son. You know, this is awful. I must do something to stop it. You know, maybe he thought that he had to go buy more hand sanitizers, maybe gloves, and maybe even a mask or two for good measure. Whatever it was, he didn't allow himself to think and to realize that beyond the physical, which certainly does exist, there is a ruchniistic cause for all of this. I'm supposed to take the message. I'm supposed to stop building the city. I have to make an about face. Isn't it interesting how human nature hasn't changed much? It's so much easier for us, for all of us, to attribute everything going on in the world to the physical world, to the bat, to the Chinese, to the germs, viruses, right? Rather than looking inside of us, because looking inside of us is so hard. And I would add, when we do look inside of us, it's so much easier to point the blame at what everyone else is doing, right? It's because they're not makbid enough on Kedushas Beis HaMidrash. It's because they're too involved in technology. It's because they speak too much Lashon Hara. It's because there's so much Sinas Chinam among those groups, right? It's so much easier to look inside of others rather than point a finger at ourselves and say, this is what Hashem is telling me. I once heard Mrs. Esther Baylor Schwartz of Muncie speaking, and she said a terrific quote. She said, "The brain is an amazing organ that can justify decisions that the heart already made." Again, the brain is an amazing organ that can justify decisions that the heart already made. We all want to live a certain way with priorities that we've already set. We want our day to take on a certain routine in a way that's comfortable, that's normal for us. We want to look a certain image that we want to keep up, again, that we've already determined. Our heart's already made all these decisions. And so it's so easy for us to stop and to say that this is the way we're supposed to do it, right? It's so easy for us, for our brain to justify that this is the way we're supposed to be living. This is normal. This is good. This is right. This is correct. And it's so hard for us to stop, to take stock, and to think, is this really right? Or maybe should it be tweaked a little? Maybe does Hashem want something else, slightly different? Maybe he wants me to stretch a little, to change a bit, to grow a little bit. But again, it's so hard because, again, our brain justifies those decisions that our heart already made. You know, I'm fond of telling the story of when I was a young 16-year-old with a fresh driver's license in my hand. And one summer, my mother asked me if I would drive with her, make a trip from the mountains into Baltimore and then back from Baltimore to the mountains later that evening. Now, of course, you know, I'm not one to turn down an opportunity for Cuba Dame. So, you know, of course I was going to, you know, help her out with this driving. So we make the trip into Baltimore, which I don't remember much. So I guess it was uneventful. And then the way back, my mother starts driving and she's driving and driving. And then she gets a little tired and she pulls into a Restop and asks me if I would take over the wheel. Now, this is my shining moment of glory, so of course I would. So we switch seats. My mother promptly falls asleep. I pull out of the rest stop, and I knew that I just had to go basically straight on 83 the entire way until I'd be much closer. And I pull out of the rest stop, and I start driving and driving. And I'm driving and driving and driving and driving and enjoying every minute of it thoroughly. Until I see a sign that says, "Welcome to Maryland." Now, welcome to Maryland, that wasn't supposed to happen. I mean, we left Maryland ages ago. And so in that, like, you know, split second that I saw the sign, "Welcome to Maryland," and I passed the sign, I told myself, it must not have said welcome to Maryland. It must have said something about, like, goodbye from Maryland. I don't know, maybe it said welcome to somewhere else, Delaware. I don't know, but it couldn't have said welcome to Maryland because we had obviously left Maryland a long time ago. We certainly weren't going back toward Maryland. And I continued driving, thinking nothing of it. It wasn't until a while later when my mother woke up and she looks around and says, "Where are we?" I said, "I don't know, I'm just driving on 83. And she looks a little bit more alertly around and says, "Why are we just about back in Baltimore?" And I said, "I don't know, I was just driving." And yes, I had turned out of the rest stop and gone south instead of north. And I was basically making the trip in the wrong direction. And at the time, I was, like, so frustrated with myself. And I was thinking, like, how could I have not seen the signs? Like, I saw it said, "Welcome to Maryland," and I noticed other signs, and it looked strange. Like, why didn't I realize I was going the wrong way? Why didn't I make an about face? But really, now I understand. That's human nature. That's the way we all are. We don't like to admit that we made a mistake. It's so hard to take an about face, and therefore we'll do anything to convince ourselves that we're okay and that everything's fine and that we don't have to change. When this happens in the physical world, when it happens with, you know, driving on highways, you know, it's okay. My mother was a pretty good sport about it. When it happens within the highway of our lives and we're too sleepy, we're too stubborn to make an about face, then it could be tragic. It's pathetic. And frankly, it's quite frightening. We don't want Hashem Chas V'Shalom to have to rustle the branches closer, more intensely. We don't want the alarm clock to get louder. We want to be able to say, "Hashem, I got it. I'm up. I took the message. I'm doing something. I'm changing. I'm looking inside of myself, right? At what I need to change, what I need to work on." You know, I was recently speaking to someone on this topic. And she said, "Okay, so, you know, we got the message. We're awake. We realize that Hashem's telling us something. We realize this is a message. I realize I have to look inside. We're aroused. But who says it's going to last? Like, who says we're going to stay this way?" And really, if you think about it, she was echoing a simple fact of human nature, that as human beings, we're aroused, we're inspired, I might say rather easily, and we land just as easily. You know, even by Kriyas Yamsuf we have that Rasa Shifra Laya Mashalora Yechazkel Bambuzi, that the lowly, ordinary maidservant had a level of nevuah that was higher even than Yechazkel Bambuzi, one of the greatest of Nevi'im. And yet we know that looking forward, the Shifra remained the Shifra and the Nevi'im remained Nevi'im, right? It wasn't a nation of Nevi'im. It wasn't that everyone in Klal Yisrael was a Navi. The Shifra didn't stay a Navi. She became a Shifra again, meaning she landed. She was back down to earth. So really, that's true. That's just the way it is. That's just an aspect of human nature, that we get aroused and we land and we're inspired and then we're back to normal. Real everlasting change is very, very hard. And I think that's what this person was telling me. Like, so fine. So it's so hard for us to admit that we've made a mistake. But now we did, right? Now we admit that there's something we have to work on. But like, what's going to make it last? So I think the answer lies, Reb Chaim Shmuel Levis addresses this in Sichos Musar. And he speaks about learning from Palti ben Laish. I assume you're familiar with Palti ben Laish, who Shaul gave to his daughter Michal as a husband. We know that Shaul gave Michal to Palti after Michal was already married to David, because Shaul paskened lahalacha that Michal's marriage to David was not complete, and therefore she was free to marry someone else. However, Palti realized that in this case Shaul was mistaken in his psak, and that Michal was in fact an Ishus Ish, and therefore that he couldn't marry her. He was horrified, mortified at the thought that he was being given an Ishus Ish and that he should take an Ishus Ish. But he knew the idea that we just said. He knew that the way of the world is that inspiration wears off. He knew that if he would just leave it, his horrification, his mortification wouldn't last very long. He would adjust. He would start rationalizing. He would get used to the idea that maybe it is okay for me to take her. You know, after all, Shaul said it's okay. You know, Shaul's a pretty chashuv person. He's a melech. I can rely on him. So what did he do to make sure that that wouldn't happen? What did he do to make sure that he wouldn't just land, that he wouldn't just, you know, come back to earth? So we know that he took a sword and he placed the sword between them. And he said that anyone who passes this sword should be struck by a sword. And apparently his plan worked because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was meyid that Palti wasn't chote. And Hashem added his name to Palti's name, which is why he's called Paltiel instead of Palti. Now, sounds nice, but if you think about it, what's the big idea with this sword? I mean, why was the sword so effective? Was the sword automatic? I assume not. The sword had no hidden camera. You know, the sword wasn't going to do anything. It was just a plain old sword that he put there. In a moment of weakness, he could remove the sword. Or in a moment of weakness, he didn't even have to remove the sword. In a moment of weakness, he could ignore the sword. So what's the big idea with the sword? Why was the sword such a lifesaver? Why was the sword so, you know, impressive? Oh, look what Palti did. So he answers that the effectiveness of the sword lie in the fact that it was an action, that it was something concrete, that it was something physical, it was something practical. He did something. He didn't just leave the inspiration to die down. He did something that he could see, that he could touch, that he could feel, that he could look at, right? And he could recall his initial feelings of horrification, mortification, that could remind him, and then that would stop him from adjusting, from slowly landing, from slowly just getting back to the way he was before. And maybe, just maybe, this is the answer to our question. If inspiration is left on its own, then it's true. It will just die down. It will leave us unchanged. It will leave us back to the way we were beforehand. But if we work on it, if we act on it immediately, if we do something practical, something physical, something tangible, if we take on a practical, small Kabbalah and start it immediately, if we write something down to remind us of what we're feeling of right now and what we're taking upon ourselves, if we speak it out, if we talk to someone about it, right? Do something practical, physical, tangible. Then maybe, just maybe, we can prevent those feelings from dying down. Maybe we could make it that these feelings that we have, that these feelings of hisoros, that these feelings of wanting to change, that these feelings of wanting to take the message, that these feelings of wanting to, Hashem, I'll do it because I realize that you're speaking to me, that these feelings will last and that it will really leave us different people. Halavai, all of us, each of us in our own way, we should take all the inspiration that's available. We should feel uplifted. We should feel these feelings of hisoros, of wanting to change. We should get the message, again, the message that applies to each one of us as an individual, but not stop there. We should do something concrete. We should do something real to make it last and emerge from it different people, right? Better than we were before. Hatzlacha Rabba, have a Chag Kasher v'Sameach.